are listening to On the Shoulders of Dwarves, a weekly podcast about role-playing games and role-playing gamers.
On the Shoulders of Dwarves.
Hello and welcome to On the Shoulders of Dwarves, a weekly podcast about role-playing games and the players who game them, the GMs who play them, and the gamers who play the GMs that game them. My name is Ran Aviram.
My name is Uri Lipschitz. Hello.
And today we have a guest. Drew Hayes, introduce yourself.
Hi, I am Drew Hayes, author of book series such as Superpowered, Fred the Vampire Accountant, Spells, Swords, and Stealth, the latest of which, Siege Tactics, actually just came out on audiobook. And let's see. Oh, God. Oh, and the Villains Code series. Just trying to remember which series I still had up.
And what's your connection to role-playing games?
Many. So the Spells, Swords, and Stealth series starts with a book called NPCs. So the premise of that whole sort of series is, what if NPCs had agency and the impacts of role players were more consequential than we considered? I also am tied heavily to role-playing in that I am the GM for the Authors and Dragons podcast, which is a podcast of very terrible players and me just trying to get through. And those terrible players also happen to be fellow fantasy authors, such as John Hartness, Rick Gualtieri, Joseph Brassey, Steve Weatherill, and Robert Bevan. So I've been doing that one for 3 years. And I also just play RPGs in my personal life. I started D&D 3.5 edition when I was 15 years old. So I have been playing for 18 years. Yeah, I've been playing D&D longer than I haven't been playing D&D, when you look at my life.
Of course, Authors and Dragons, you can find at authorsanddragons.com. And for pretty much everything we're going to mention here, there's a link in the show notes.
Uri, how about you explain to us, why is Drew here? Because it is all up to you and it's all thanks to you.
Well, I don't know why Drew is here, like in the grand scheme of things. I'm sure God has a purpose by placing Drew on this wonderful earth to spread the joy of fantasy writing, etc. But to be more specific, why is Drew here on this podcast is, A, because I am a huge fan of his books, which is saying a lot because I think I have a good taste. But apart from that, some of the books that Drew wrote really, really influenced me in how I run my games, which is not something that happens often. While many times we encourage people to borrow from source material which they like, it's not often time that I encountered works of art that got me to reconsider how I build my world, how I build my characters, and how I run my games. And I started reading Drew's novels with NPCs, which he mentioned beforehand. And right off the bat, that got me thinking about the existence of the world without the player characters or any player characters, and about the whole political and sociological ecosystem of fantasy worlds. I just thought to myself, hey, wouldn't it be awesome to get Drew to talk about how he creates these worlds and how he creates these stories and how he creates his NPCs, which there are a wealth of in every single book, with such depth. So, Drew, you are here to, well, stand up and address these issues.
I will answer for my crimes.
More or less. But let's start off with something we ask pretty much every guest that we have here. Where are you from, and what can you tell us about the RPG community there?
Oh, man. I'm from, let's just say, Texas in general, because I've kind of lived all over the state at various points in my life. Growing up, the RPG community was limited to basically me and my other theater nerd friends. I actually got involved in D&D because one of my best buddies ended up in a game and he decided to start his own. And he was like, hey, man, you want to play? And I said, sure. So that was my whole... That was my old journey. So my friend asked me if I wanted to come over on Sunday and try some game, and I said, sure. it was a lot of fun. But, of course, you know, it was still D&D in Southeast Texas, so very limited. College was a lot more fun. That was sort of the heyday because it was big enough that you could just spam the random nerd introduction questions at a meeting and eventually meet somebody who had similar interests to you. So that was a lot of fun, interpersonal D&D. Like, we were playing multiple games. Everybody was DMing something. It was friggin' awesome. And then college ended, and with that, pretty much ended my in-person D&D, halcyon years. Because, you know, once you all split off from college, you know, you're just trying to get where you are. Fortunately, the advent of digital gaming allowed me a few years ago to get back into it. So I started playing personal games with friends who had, you know, obviously drifted apart. And it allowed us to start the Authors and Dragons podcast because none of us live near one another. Joe's up in Seattle. John Hartness is in North Carolina. Rick Gualteri's in Jersey. Bevan's in Atlanta. I'm in Texas. And Steve Weatherall's over in England. So truly, I haven't had an in-person, like, I don't know anything about the Texas role-playing community anymore because after Mind Fractured, I ended up turning to a digital solution.
Do you consider yourself part of community now, or are you part of the... there's no such thing as an online community. There are hundreds of those. But do you consider yourself a part of a gaming community, or do you just have your home game?
I mean, I would consider the Authors and Dragons fan base and team my gaming community at this point, because it truly is the one where I have the most interaction. I spend the most time. We have a Discord off our Patreon where we hang out and talk. So, I mean, that is the most social gaming community that I have access to, would be the Authors and Dragons team and fan base. Again, like, there might probably be something kind of near me, but unless you're in a major centralized area, it's fairly hard to find a group, I think, still. Although there might be better online options. It's something I haven't explored to the extent that I probably should.
A few other questions, rapid fire, I hope you don't mind. Now, I know many GMs whose dream it is to be authors and write down the stories of their past campaign. We've all been there at some point in our life. And in that viewpoint, you're basically living the dream. Can you tell us of any skills and abilities that you have learned as a GM or as a player and that you are now utilizing as an author?
It probably most comes into play when I'm writing the PC characters, because I do sort of have to get right back into the, all right, you know this game, you know these systems. Think how can you use them? Think how can you push them? You know, you try and solve problems the way you know a role player will solve problems because you want it to be an authentic and realistic character. And I guess it probably swings over on the GM side. As I'm building traps and problems, I'm always thinking like, okay, but this isn't just a fantasy world. It has to be within the role-playing tone. It has to feel like something you would craft as a GM. So probably it mostly impacts the authenticity that I'm able to bring. Hopefully it impacts the authenticity I'm able to bring.
And yeah, for me, when reading NPC and the whole Spell, Swords, and Stealth series, I felt, yeah, this guy gets it. If Drew Hayes is not a role player, I would be really, really surprised. Because a lot of the little things are a thing that if you haven't played the game, you will never get.
Well, thank you. I'm glad that works.
Definitely. So let's talk world building. Now, as a reader, it seems like you nitpick your own work very thoroughly, which is, I can tell you from experience, not easy when creating fantasy or superheroes world. Now, do you have any specific process when you do world building, or you just use a group of really, really proficient nitpickers?
No, I do it all myself. I think probably the most honest way to say it is I'm just someone who daydreams a lot and really nitpicks my own daydreams until I that wouldn't work because like you haven't built any sort of system. All right, well, now you have to build a system. So like that makes sense. And truly, it is just I am a little bit obsessive. And so I learned early on that if I just sort of obsess about my worlds and my work, that tends to be my best use of that energy, because that leads to me coming up with more and more in-depth ideas and systems. I also like building systems. That's why I used to work in data. So that to me is just an authentic fun part of the process. So that might not be as fun for other writers, and that might be why I spend more time in it than they might.
I'm curious. Have you read Brendan Sanderson?
I have not. I've heard really great things, but unfortunately, like, only last year did I wrap Superpowers, and I was trying very hard to stay away from other superhero fiction.
Okay.
Because I was working on that for like, I want to say like 9 years. And when you're in that span, it's real easy to read something and then forget that you read it and source memory to kick in.
Yes.
And yeah, so as a general policy, I've avoided everything in that genre until SP wrapped. And now I've just been busy for the last year.
I would highly recommend him, mostly actually his fantasy works, because it seems like he really enjoys constructing magical systems specifically, and then the societies that would arise around them.
So basically, Drew, you're saying that you're working from the bottoms up sort of thing. You start off with the narrative, and then you have characters, and then there's powers, and then you say, oh, for those parts to make sense, I need the world around them to work in this specific way or that specific way.
Sometimes, honestly, so different books have taken shape in different forms. NPCs started with a concept first, whereas Forging Hephaestus, the Villains Code series, honestly started more with some characters first. And so it truly depends on what my starting point happens to be, that, because there's tons of ideas or daydreams that don't become books, that they just they're like, oh, that would be a neat thing, and then it's gone. So it sort of is just the ones that I happen to find grooves to latch onto and start filling in details and being like, oh, but I could do this and that would be cool, and I could, oh, that would be neat if I did that. And I truly can't tell you where the starting point for a lot of them is. And it does vary from one to one. It just sort of tends to be, I'll find some idea that I find really interesting, and the more I dig into it and I happen to hit other kind of related interesting ideas that grow out. So, I mean, it is important to you know, clarify. You always see the best I have to offer. So, you know, this was the optimum idea that I could pull a story out of.
It's interesting that you have a different process for developing different books, because a lot of the people I know have this similar process which every book go through. And it's really interesting to talk with someone who said, no, every book comes out of its own different idea with a different process of taking its eventual form. Now, let's talk characters a bit. What really caught me in your books is your ability to create a whole vast ensemble of really interesting and believable NPCs. Reference to NPCs, unintentional. Now, can you share with us some of your tips on character creation and character development and how to get those characters to be likable or, you know, hateable to your readers as you wish?
I truly think it's probably going to vary from author to author. In terms of building for a fantasy world or a superhero world like Superpowers I do advocate, especially if you're newer to writing, maybe building them in an RPG system. It's not something I have always done, but it is a good way to think about it when you're building characters that are going to have to fight and grapple and deal and conflict with each other in a physical space. Because it's very good if you're not comfortable dealing with that sort of power scale, to just get like a system in there and look and have an idea of what a diverse, evenly matched group would look like.
Interesting.
Because you don't want to overpower one of your characters by mistake and then have to nerf them through or anything like that. And you definitely don't want to build them without a weakness, because that's a huge problem in narrative structure as well.
Interesting.
In terms of, but outside of like, if you're not writing an action superhero-y or fantasy one, that's less important. For straight up character development, again, this is one that probably might work specifically for me, but hopefully the vein of it will get somebody. I find that I can usually write a character so long as I know what they want And I don't just mean like in the big grand scheme of things. Like, I like to know what a character wants in a given like month or day. Like, what is their prime concern? What's their long-term concern? And I've often found that once you know that about a character, the rest sort of is a lot easier to kind of connect and unfold, because you know who they are, you know where they are, you know what they want. So the next question is simply, okay, how does being here connect to what they want short term? How does it connect long term? Does it connect long term? Are they the kind of person who is, if it doesn't connect at all, well, then they're self-sabotaging. That's my way in. Once I have that, I can sort of suss out a character pretty well. But again, I don't know that would work for every author, but that's sort of the find a way into every character, even your small ones.
Interesting. It kind of, for me, touches on the Chabak method of acting, if you're familiar with it, that every character should have that which they want to achieve and that which drives them toward that, basically.
Yeah, that's a very fitting one.
Interesting. And your other tip was to basically just create a character sheet for every character.
If you're concerned about like balance or something, like if you're writing an action-y or any sort of thing where you have those components, and I wasn't super worried about it because I've built so many characters for all these RPGs that I can eyeball characters and be like, no, that one's way too strong for this setting. But if you're a newer author and you don't have that familiarity, like using a system to just build, and they don't have to be perfect versions of your characters. You still have narrative license, change as you needed, but like building some version of them and kind of seeing like, okay, this one, as I have built him, doesn't work. Like I can't build him in the system, which means he's way too strong. Or this one, like she's got a ton of points left over. Like once I've done everything I wanted her to have. So she probably needs a little bit of shoring up. That it's a good tool for people who are wanting to like break into like a superhero style story of character balancing.
Did you use this Mutants and Mastermind?
You know, I don't, purely because I hate to say this. I love Mutants and Masterminds. It's really fun. It's not a balanced system.
Oh,
it's
okay.
So it's very easy to accidentally make a broken character in Mutants and yep. Masterminds. And so, you know, I love playing Mutants and Masterminds. I've played in that game several times. But if I were trying to build balanced characters, I wouldn't use Mutants and Masterminds as a system.
I have to agree, unless that's what you're going for. I mean, the last time I played Mutants and Mastermind, my character got hit over by a bus, a plane crashed on it, and, you know, they shrugged it off and moved forward. Mutant and Mastermind is an excellent system for playing over-the-top superhero games, but over-the-top superheroes are usually not well-balanced, not even with each other.
And that only matters as much as you care about. Like, for example, this whole idea of like keeping everything in balance and everything is very important for superpowers. But the Villains Code series, that power scale is wholly different. And like, there's not even attempted at balance at that one, because you've got just people playing on such entirely different scales of power that there would be the idea of balance in that world is ludicrous to begin with.
But that's part of the point, though.
It's a throwback to like Gold and Silver Age comic books, when just shit was completely off the walls. Anything could happen. And to capture the spirit of that, you can't worry about things like balance. Yeah. You have to be like, no, it's just the world is chaos. Good luck.
Okay. Now, Drew, you have an actual play podcast that you have mentioned before. It's called Authors and Dragon, where you run an adventure for several fantasy author. How did that got started?
So that one was a truly just a random day that snowballed, honest to God. So I'm not sure if y'all are familiar, but when I do a book launch, I have a tradition where whenever we have speed readers or some of our betas who leave good reviews on launch day, I do a shot. I'm always like on social media on launch days. I'm usually throwing a social media launch party, so I'm taking shots, posting pictures through the day. That's only relevant to say that this was a launch day toward the end, so I was fairly buzzed. And me and Robert Bevan of Caverns and Creatures, we sort of kind of knew each other in that way that some professional authors in the same bubbles will just kind of know each other. And
you follow each other on Twitter.
Right. Like, and we had talked on Facebook a few times because we shared a lot of core audience with the NPCs, Caverns and Creatures thing. But he and I were just kind of shooting the shit. And I was talking about how actually it was a Mutants and Masterminds game I'd been playing in the week before. And just had gone completely off the rails so fast. And I was telling him, I was like, God, I wish we recorded these things because they're so stupid funny. And that really just led he and I into discussing the heck he really wanted to play D&D, but he'd never been able to. So we're like, well, what if we did D&D, but like our twist on it is that it's authors. And we're like, do you think we could get enough people? And he's like, I mean, I can reach out to some people. And so we started reaching out to people. And by the time the dust settled, we had gotten together the Authors and Dragons crew, and there were a few shifts and bumps along the way. John Hartness had to leave for a little bit, and then we ended up replacing him with Steve Weatherall, who we loved so much that when John came back, we just kept them both. We're like, yeah, no, Steve's fantastic. Robert Cruzy had to jump out like I think about half a year in just because his life got too busy. But since then, like, we've been fairly stable, and in fact, it's been growing more and more each year. This year, our Patreon funded side quests. So because we're all very busy people, we can only do an episode every 2 weeks of Authors and Dragons. Side quest is going to be our in between. And that's where we sort of just do a more loose form general podcast. We've played different games on it. We've had random discussions on it. We just sort of have fun with that one. But now we're weekly because SideQuest is filling in those gaps. So that was an awesome thing. And in 2018, we launched Shingles, which are our monthly novella series. They are a monthly novella series of fantasy horror book or of comedy horror books based on a skin condition. If there are any similarities to something you might have read in childhood, that's your own shit. And parody law protects us.
Yeah.
So we did the first year of Shingles, and it's great. The stories are completely off the wall ridiculous. The first one is The Ghost of Hooker Alley by Robert Bevan. And that really sets the tone pretty well.
So you just rotate whoever write the next book among yourself in the group?
Yeah, so they're not connected in any way. We trade off who does it. I did two last year, Aliens Wrecked Our Kegger and Slaughter on Giggle Time Mountain. they're meant to be loose and fun. And by absolute magic, the good people at Tantor were willing to give us an audiobook collection of the first six that came out last year. And I think actually this is the first place we're ever announcing it because I've just found out today. They have a release date for the second audio collection, and that will be May 7th, 2019. So Shingles Volume 2, 7 through 12, out May 7th.
Brilliant.
Woohoo!
And that's been a fun one. And it's the simple joy of having other people who are in my job, in my life, in a casual setting. Because when you work from home, you sort of lose the coworker aspect. And so having that social thing in my day has been wonderful.
I'm sure Iran can sympathize with that.
This is what I do with you, Uri. I mean, this podcast is one of the ways that I have to remain in contact with the world.
Yeah, I hear you, man.
You heard it, listeners. If you want to join the Author and Dragons game, all you need to do is become a fantasy author and then wait for one of the people in the group to die. And then suggest yourself.
That's the only way.
Yeah, that's the only way. Also, we've had guests on occasionally. But, I mean, you still got to work your way up through the author part. That's non-conditional.
and you need to learn how to play D&D, but that's...
I would say that, but if you listen to the early D&D episodes, it's readily apparent that was not a requirement. It's been a fun one. There's a reason... Part of our tagline is people playing Dungeons and Dragons poorly.
Now, there's a bunch of questions which we got from listeners when I mentioned that we'll possibly do an interview with you. And I'm just going to let you answer them so people will be happy that they got an answer for their question.
Sounds good.
Now, regarding sources of inspiration, did anything that appears in one of your books originated from one of your role-playing sessions?
God, I mean, I don't think so. I get this question and I've really dug through mentally and tried to think. It's entirely possible I reused a trap or, oh, actually one thing does get reused. Mm. I reused a lot of my random city names from when I used to run games. Immediately every time I'm like, shit, I need a name for a kingdom. Oh, all right, I'll just pull one of those. So that is the one thing that did get reused a lot was the titles of cities. Other than that, I might have like re-pulled a trap or something just from my own brain. But the situations in the book are specifically tailored to the characters and the plot and et cetera. So it's, there's not really been an opportunity to cram something from that in. And truly I'd be more likely to fit in something from an A&D game, 'cause that would be a joke that everyone would get, not just me.
Mm.
Wow, you just broke my heart a little bit. There's specifically one thing in the Spell Swords and Stealth series which I was certain, like 112% certain, that actually you took out from one of your gaming sessions. I'm not going to mention which one because it's a partial spoiler. So, we're going to pause the recording now and then I'm going to ask you and then we're going to come back. So, okay. Click! And we're back after an unrecorded conversation. I am feeling better.
All of this gets cut. That's fine.
All of this gets cut. I don't care. I got an answer for my question. So, another question from our listeners. Drew, did you sell the movie rights for Superpowered? And what is your dream casting for that series?
So no, Superpowered's movie rights are still owned by me. So actually, I'll go ahead and bust into this a little bit, because this is sort of a good thing to know for anybody who's actually interested in doing writing and owning your own properties. So how movie rights tend to work is you won't generally sell your movie rights straightforwardly. What will happen is if you are very fortunate, they will get optioned and you might get, I don't know, a couple grand off of the option. And what that means is that you can't sell your movie rights to someone for a specific period of time, maybe a year, while the person who has optioned them takes it around and shops it to studios or producers or what have you. That's a side of the business I do not have in-depth knowledge about. And then if the option is picked up, then production can begin. If you get a green light, there's so many steps. Like getting optioned is the number of books that get optioned compared to the number of books that get made as movies is probably in terms of percentage comparable to the number of books that get written versus the number of books that get published. It's truly like that's just one step forward. So that's one to know if you are out there planning to turn your book into a movie. Understand that you are climbing an entirely different lottery-sized mountain after that one. Mm-hmm. But, you know, obviously, of course, we all hold out the hopes. And so, yeah, if you're interested in optioning Superpowered, by all means, give me an email. it's not currently optioned right now. So it is, as of this recording, available for optioning. I can only really dream cast a few characters because the problem with, you know, if we're talking about Superpowered, most of the cast is young. And so for that to cast, like I would have to be like, okay, who are the people in the right age bracket right now? And so it's just not really something I keep up with. I'd love for The Rock as Titan, just because I'm a big old school wrestling fan and The Rock is huge, and I think he would fit very well. I think he's got the right sort of personality. I don't know. That's sort of the only one I have, because the rest of them are just too fluid.
That's a good answer. Now, we have a question about what is selling better, books, audiobooks, or e-readers, e-versions of the book. But the reason I'm feeling comfortable asking this question is because you have been very straightforward in
your
work and very open about what you do and how you do that in your blog and about the whole process of writing and publishing, which I find invaluable, by the way. So feel free to answer as much or not so much as you would care to share?
Well, I can speak in generalities and specifics. And to start with the generality, print is not in that race. It exists and it has an industry and there are people who buy print books and love them. And that is absolutely fantastic. But in terms of who is selling the most, print has been out of that run for a very long time and is probably not going to catch up unless there's some, unless like all technology,
the internet,
basically. Yeah.
Yeah.
We call it Brexit over here.
Yeah. So audiobook versus e-readers is a little more interesting. I think in terms of the generality and this, I could very easily be wrong on this, but just based on talking to other authors and publishers and what I know, I think ebook can be safely said to be the dominant sales form right now. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong, but based on what I've seen, that seems accurate. So that generalities, that's the end of that. Specifics for me, I'd have to go back and double check my numbers, but I'm pretty sure I sold more audiobooks in 2019 than I did ebooks. But that needs to be quantified with I have an extremely healthy audiobook audience. I write very long books, which based under Audible's credit system, kind of represent a greater return on cost, because if everything costs the same, then a book you enjoy that is 6 hours versus a book you enjoy that is 29 hours, the 29 hour book is going to get your credit. You know, assuming you have liked the series and et cetera, this is all still predicated on writing books that people enjoy. But because I write very long books that have so far, thankfully, been well received by the listeners, my audiobook market is probably a little bit healthier than what your average independent author would have. So my audiobook is outpacing my ebook right now. I do not feel like that's the sort of thing I could say as a generality with any sort of safety.
Which is a great follow-up for my next questions. How much, if at all, are you involved in the audiobook creation process?
Minimally. It's the simple truth is we talked earlier, I think, that I write a fair amount. I have a good output of books. So far I have released at least 3 books every year, and that's not even counting the shingles novellas and the fun little one-offs, like 3 novels per year. So if you do an
audiobook, pause for applause.
Yeah. If you do an audiobook through ACX, Amazon Creation Services, which is the indie equivalent of how you would, it's how a lot of indie authors get their audiobooks made. You have to find a narrator, reach an agreement, get the proofs back. You have to listen to the entirety of the audiobook. If there's any issues, you have to let them know. You have to listen to the corrections. It is an extremely time consuming process, and I don't have the time for that, but thankfully I've been working with Tantor Audio for, oh my God, years now. And they've been doing a fantastic job. Almost everything I have that is audio has been released through Tantor. The Superpowered series, where they paired me with Kyle McCarley as the narrator, who does an outstanding job with a wide range of voices. The Spell, Sword, and Stealth series, narrated by Roger Wayne. Man, that guy's got an awesome voice. The Fred books, narrated by Kirby Hayborn, who is just out. I actually got to meet him in person. Super nice guy, and the voice of Fred at this point in my head. Mm-hmm. And of course, Amy Landon from The Villain's Code. Also wonderful woman who did a great job with a wide range of voices. God bless her. So, you know, that's all Tantor, we talk. I say, hey, these are the books I'm planning to write this year. They say, cool, we would like to make audiobooks of these. Cool. A few months later, here is the finished manuscript. Awesome. Are you comfortable with either continuing with this narrator or changing to this narrator? Like, if we're starting a new series, we have to pick a narrator. If we are continuing, then I have to decide if I'm going to stay or change. I've never changed. I love their narrators. I'm never going to change off any of the ones in my series. They're all fantastic people. If any of those ever changed, rest assured, it was because there was a scheduling conflict. Because I love them. So then they come back and they say, okay, cool. How you feel about this for the cover? And I say, good, or fix this. And then that's it. A few months later, I get an audiobook.
Wow.
Wow.
And that's the amount of involvement I have the time for. And it was prefaced with, this has been a relationship that built very slowly. Like, we started with one book, one project, and I liked what they did. And then we just kind of kept pushing forward a little bit at a time. And now I'm completely comfortable. Like, I hand them my stuff. I listen to the narrator. They have never given me a badly produced or badly narrated book. So, but that's something you build over time. That's not narrative. I wouldn't start a relationship with that level of trust, especially in the author world.
Make a lot of sense.
The other version is an Audible original. I've done one of those, Secondhand Curses. That one was slightly more involved because Audible's actually acting as the publisher for those. So I wrote the rough draft. We went back. We did edits, conceived of a cover. So that one was a little bit more akin to a traditional publishing process. But for the most part, my involvement in the audiobook creation process, but even that one was still, okay, we've written the book together. Awesome. How you feel about these narrators? They sound great. Awesome. We'll have a book for you in a few months.
Wow. Months?
I mean, usually. Because one, they have to record it. Then they have to, of course, edit, streamline, make it sound very nice. And so you also have to get everyone's schedules lined up. So Secondhand Curses had three narrators. So, you know, we had to go through getting the time for each of those. And then, of course, once it's done, it doesn't go right out the door. You put it on pre-order. You build up the hype. There's I'm sure they do some marketing stuff. So, yeah, it usually takes a couple of months for a normal book. And then when you get into like the superpowers books, it's a bigger delay. Anything that's that long, just because, I mean, it's I write what is equivalent to three books and call it one in a lot of these cases based on word count measurements.
Hmm.
So it makes sense to me that it's like, yeah, it's going to take them a little extra longer to record all that.
Makes a lot of sense. Yes. So tell me, is Fred based on a real person that you know?
No. None of my characters are based on real people. My people I know read my books, so that would be awkward in the first place. And then I've just never met a person who happened to be the exact combination of character traits that I needed for a protagonist.
Really? You've never met a pension who was both a vampire and an accountant?
Well, I just mean, like, from a personality standpoint, I've never met a human being who I immediately said, I should write a book about someone like you. I mean, like, I might write, like, a trait, like, oh, that boldness, that's good. Or, you know, I might pick a quirk or something, but much like the traps and the D&D stuff, the characters have to be molded to best fit the story. And so I don't start from the basis of, oh, they'll be like this. I start from, okay, I make something custom for this plot.
Awesome. I can see that we've been talking for a while. So I want to ask a summarization question. You are currently writing books and running a D&D campaign. Can you give me one similarity and one major difference between how you prepare for each?
Okay, a similarity is I try not to think more than a game ahead in terms of specifics. And so, especially if you've listened to A&D, part of it is just everything going off the rails. So when they're in a room, whatever the next room they could go to is, I've built that. But I haven't built anything past those because I know they won't get past it, and so I'm not worried. And it's sort of the same in writing. I do absolutely advocate know your endings, have some general ideas of where your story is going. I advocate a thing I call checkpoint writing, where I know the major events that have to happen, and then I sort of leave the space between for improvisation and character growth. But that is sort of very similar. Is when I'm sitting down to write, like on Monday, I know the next chapter I'm going to write. And I sort of know what's going to happen in the chapter that follows in like a specific, I know the beats I'm going to be hitting. I don't know the specifics of anything past that, but I do know the major checkpoints that I'm building toward, and etc. So it's similar in that I try to keep my eyes on the next task, the next chapter, the next thing that I have to worry about the crunchy stuff for, getting the traps, laying the narrative pipework, knowing my beats, all that stuff. The major difference is, of course, that I don't have the ability to veto improvisation when it happens in a game. Like, if a character starts kind of going off in a weird area, I can be like, oh, that could be a fun idea to trail down. Or I could be like, no, that's a waste of time. In D&D, you just got to roll with it, man. You're not the only person who's creating stuff, and you have to be open to whatever's coming next.
Words to live by, definitely. Well, in summary, first of all, Drew, thank you very much for agreeing to join us here on the Shoulders of Dwarves. There aren't many times in which we can have an interview with someone who's really a prominent author in his own field and an avid role-player game who's really willing to share both of these fields of his life together with us. And we really appreciate you coming here. And everyone who's listening, go and buy Drew's books. And trust me, you're going to have a load of fun. It's an awesome ride. Go on it.
Well, thank you, man. And thank you for having me on.
If you want to hear more of this, please go to dwarfcast.net. And if you want to send us an email, do so at show@dwarfcast.net. And if you desire to hear more of us, you can do so right after the beep, because now it's time to take the load off. Beep!
This world is carried on the shoulders of dwarves.
This is the part of the show in which we talk a bit about role-playing games in our personal lives and what we've been doing this past week. I shall begin. It's very short. I am again playing, which is new to me, 50 Fathoms, Savage Worlds. It's brilliant. Pirates. We had a jailbreak. That is, we broke into a jail. And I wanted to do it as what is called a dramatic task, which is just some players roll some dice and you say, well, we did it or we didn't do it. We succeeded or we failed, but I forgot that I wanted to do it as a dramatic task when we started the session, and instead we played 4 hours, the full battle, the full combat of assaulting the jail. I planned other things for the session, but I forgot that I did that. So that was my game.
Sounds awesome. My players in my current campaign, Unrelated Incidents, said that the last adventure was a bit dark, so I started a new adventure, and it's called The Coming of the Lord of Pain, to keep it lighthearted. And I wanted to make the game session feel something integrated to the setting and their characters. So I used a new rumor mechanism, which was basically I asked everyone around the table to describe an activity that their character did with an NPC during the last few weeks. And they said, my character went with this NPC to a restaurant, and my character went on a trip with this NPC, blah, blah, blah. And then I asked each and every one of them to describe one thing during that event which caught their eye, which was a little bit strange. So they said, okay, there was this weird waiter who kept taking out glasses of water and placing them on the sidewalk. And they said, okay, there's a troop of actors who keep roaming the woods around town. And then I said, okay, now, please tell me, how is this strange happening that your character has noticed, once investigated, was related to this mysterious figure known as the Lord of Pain? And rumor has it that he is approaching the town. And my players went bananas over that. They were like, oh, the rumor is that the Lord of Pain is walking to town from a long way away, and he's going to be very thirsty when he comes. So people, random people, are just taking out glasses of water and placing them on the sidewalk for him to drink. Or another player said, oh, the Lord of Pain, he's this really amazing director, who, and all the players from the neighborhood and neighboring cities are coming over, and there's not enough room to house them all. So they live in the forest and, you know, working on their place. And I got these amazing 4 origin stories for this character, this Lord of Pain. And now I had my own you know, origin story because I planned this adventure ahead of time. But now I have to say I'm really tempted to just throw what I planned out the window and say, oh, wow, these stories are so much better. I'm going to use some of these. So this new rumor mechanic really, I want to play more with that.
Yeah, it seems like you're having fun with it, man.
Mm-hmm. Drew, you want to sell something from your Author and Dragons game?
Oh, God, what have they been doing? I'll do one from a personal game. It's not super unique in terms of what happened, but it was really fun. So my buddy has actually been testing out a modularized point-by version of D&D 5e that he created. And functionally how that works is there's no classes, but every time you finish a battle, you gain your XP is just like a smaller pool of points. Like you might gain like 30 XP at the end of a fight, and buying another hit die in your hit point is 8 points. Picking up like an extra key point for a monk is 3 points. But again, like there's no class requirements. There's only like prereq and ability requirements. So like anybody can take awesome. Monk speed as long as you got a dex 13. That's just free. If you spend points and you've got the prereq, it's yours. So we're all building like these sort of custom hybrid characters that have been a lot of fun. And my shape-shifting barbarian started taking some monk stuff, and I got to test him out on a demon, and it was a lot of fun. I got to teleport around and punch him in the face.
Sounds super broken.
Oh, yeah. I mean, but he's putting us against Baylors, so I mean...
So, yeah, sure.
Yeah, it's a fair matchup. But, yeah, we're playtesting the system for my buddy, and we're having a ton of fun. Again, it's sort of like M&M. It's not balanced, but it's fun.
Yeah. But it sounds awesome, and it sounds like there's something there. I really like the tiny little choices that you get after each fight. Now I can spend some XPs and buy some things, and it's exciting.
Oh, it is. It makes the end of every session so much fun because you're like, instead of being like, hey, I'm 1/16th closer to doing something, you're like, all right, I got 10 points. What can I do? Do I save it up? Am I hiding for something big? Ooh, or do I want to get some like little ones to help me in the next fight? And it's cool because you're like adapting as you build your character. Like I started taking monk stuff after I got held, and I was like, oh, that's not happening again. and so I was like, all right, awesome. Shadow monk, teleportation, the hell with this.
Yeah. Brilliant.
Do you know there was a gaming system called... Big Eyes, Small Mouth.
Bessem, yeah. Anime. Played that in college.
Oh, wow. Awesome. Now, there's a version of that, a D20 adaptation of BESM. It's called BESM D20.
Okay, I think that's actually the one I played. I'm sorry. I didn't know that was two.
Oh, well, happy to help. And there you could play specific classes, like, you know, the mecha, the magician, the whatever. But you also had a class called the Adventurer. And that was basically just a pool of points, and you can take whatever you want from all the other classes combined. A lot like what you're saying right now. And I love that. I love the fact that you can mix and match. I'm a spell-casting giant robot.
What was the non-D20 Bessem on? Because the D20 one was like broken to hell. Was the original more balanced?
Yep.
They called it Tristat system.
Yep.
It's something that I think the company was called Guardians of Order, if I remember correctly.
Yep.
They went bankrupt or something a few years later. But they had this, and they had Sentinels of the Silver Age. Wow, I can't believe I remember it. Which is which was a superpower game, again, based on Tristat. Which is basically just point by your abilities. Yeah.
Interesting. I might look into that. All right. Well, awesome. Thanks, guys. I didn't know about that. I thought it was just the one.
Sure.
Glad to help. And again, thank you for coming, Drew. We're going to wrap the show up with each of us saying goodbye to our listeners in our own native tongue, whatever that may be. So in 3, 2, 1. Later.
Bye.
On the Shoulders of Dwarves is shared under Creative Commons by attribution non-commercial 4. Intro and outro are by The Cliché Duo, and you can email us at show@dwarfcast.net.
On the Shoulders of Dwarves.